As America's civil works infrastructure facilities age beyond their original design lives, so do the thousands of individual components that keep them functioning. By the year 2030, 70% of U.S. dams will be at least 50 years old, according to the American Society for Civil Engineers Infrastructure Report Card. That also means more and more of the parts within their critical mechanical and structural systems will need to be replaced. These original components were often fabricated using vintage material and manufacturing methods, making them costly, burdensome, and time-consuming to replicate. Many of these parts are unique to individual projects, meaning they can't be mass-produced, and customized molds must be located or recreated. However, funds are limited and time is of the essence. If one of these parts were to suddenly break, that failure could shut down a facility for months, causing significant national economic damage. Faced with this challenge, infrastructure managers in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, or USACE, need innovative solutions to rapidly and affordably replace critical components that have been in service for half a century or longer.
Advances in additive manufacturing, or 3D printing, offer transformative potential in this space. As the technology has matured to support large-scale builds, ERDC has extensively studied how it could be used by the U.S. Army and Department of Defense in various capacities. Now, it is applying lessons learned from these military projects to modernize USACE infrastructure components and structures. This effort includes research into materials, manufacturing processes, and optimal designs. An important focus is to ensure additive manufacturing can meet USACE requirements for reliability, utility, and cost efficiency, particularly given the intense stresses placed on civil infrastructure. Extensive examinations have been conducted to characterize material properties of existing vintage parts and to ensure the 3D printed material can meet or exceed their performance. This research resulted in a recent collaboration with the USACE Detroit District and Lincoln Electric to manufacture the largest U.S. civil works infrastructure component produced by a 3D printer, a 12-foot-long metal part for the ship arrestor system on the Poe Lock, one of two active locks on the Sioux Locks facility. Building on years of ERDC research, the part was manufactured in 12 weeks compared to a projected 18-month lead time for conventional manufacturing. The part was installed, tested, and commissioned in March during the Sioux Locks winter maintenance cycle. The rapid repair ensured normal operations at Poe Lock, a major transit point for domestic iron ore, where an unanticipated closure would be catastrophic for the nation, according to a 2015 Department of Homeland Security study.
I'm Chris Kiefer, and with Megan Saxton, this is The Power of ERDC. Our guests today are Dr. Robert Moser and Dr. Zach McClellan from ERDC's Geotechnical and Structures Laboratory. Robert is a senior scientific technical manager for materials, manufacturing, and structures, and Zach is a research mechanical engineer. We will talk with Robert and Zach about ERDC's advanced manufacturing research and how it will enable USACE to replace large-scale vintage infrastructure components faster and at a lower cost while maintaining and even improving their properties. Robert, Zach, thank y'all for joining us today.
Thanks, Chris. It's good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
So to start off with talking on the topic of aging infrastructure, talk a little bit about just the state of infrastructure repairs and the limitations of traditional manufacturing for replacing many of these components.
You know, I think as far as the research that we do to support this area, a lot of it, and I think a lot of things we'll talk about today are around our civil works mission. And so that cuts across a lot of different application areas across the nation, from hydropower facilities to dams and other flood risk management structures, navigation locks, even water supply projects. There's all kinds of infrastructure projects, hundreds of navigation locks, almost 1,000 dams, and then all other kinds of unique facilities. The benefit that those provide to the nation is huge. It's billions and billions and billions of dollars, sure, that are provided as far as benefits to the nation. And it's all aging, even with, I think, historic investments in like the infrastructure bill recently on the order of $1 trillion. That's on the same order of the replacement value of just our assets that are past their original service life. And so this is going to continue to be a large problem that we're going to have to think of innovative ways, innovative solutions in order to modernize that aging infrastructure. And that's, you know, that's on the civil side. We could spend the same amount of time talking about the same issues on the military side when we look at bridges and rail and ports and all the other facilities that are critical there.
So when we talk about aging infrastructure, kind of what is the capacity or the limitations both for traditional manufacturing and there comes the need for innovation like you talked about. Tell us how additive manufacturing can be a game changer in that space.
That's where I think there's a lot of really awesome developments and new technology that can really reshape the way that we would do these kinds of repairs, rehabilitations to projects. And when we look at our aging infrastructure portfolio, we've got structures built, and most of them during the Industrial Revolution and post-World War II timeframe. And so manufacturing has changed a lot since then. And so there's all kinds of new things that we can do. But then the other thing is the tempo that we're doing rehabilitations and construction is a lot different than we were in the past. So we're not building hundreds of dams across the country at the same time. We're repairing one or two at a time, all of them being very different. So it opens up this new opportunity space to look at different ways of manufacturing. And one of those is using things like additive manufacturing that's getting up to scales that we can go in and replace parts that would have been typical castings maybe 100 years ago and look at new ways to do that.
And for the sake of clarity, when we talk about additive manufacturing, is that as simple as a synonym for 3D printing or what is there more to additive manufacturing than that?
Yeah, I'll definitely step in here. It's a good place to kind of set the stage, if you will. A lot of people use them synonymously for 3D printing and additive manufacturing, but traditionally, especially in the research world, 3D printing would be associated more with kind of hobbyist work. So like smaller scale polymer prints, which you traditionally think of as like being in small schools or having at home. Mm-hmm. And then additive manufacturing is more of kind of an industrial base, right? So larger scale, actual manufacturing capability that encompasses a lot more than just the small 3D printing CAD type work. One is the same as the other, but not necessarily like vice versa. But yeah, that's kind of the difference. One, industrialization versus kind of hobbyist.
Sure. Big picture, which obviously is where you all, and we'll get more in that discussion, but kind of the interest is where we can do this on a large scale.
Exactly.
Especially when you're talking about infrastructure.
Yep.
How did Arctic get involved in 3D printing and how has that capability evolved?
You know, the first thing I guess I would put out there is I don't think this is, at least in its current form, something that's totally new, right? People have been doing additive-like manufacturing for probably, upwards of a couple decades.
Yep.
And so it's really getting into more high-performance materials and real engineering applications that's the new thing that really over the last decade, but especially the last 5 years, has really taken off. And so, you know, I think across the Department of Energy, across the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, there is so much work in advanced manufacturing going on. But as far as, you know, what have we done here at IRTA, kind of what is our unique mission set in advanced manufacturing? A lot of it started, I would say, probably 5 to 7 years ago. And so we were starting to dabble in advanced manufacturing for metals and polymers and things, how that would feed into projects, and at least at that time, primarily in our military engineering mission set. But the other large program that stood up then, which was really interesting new work, was actually through our environmental quality mission. As the Army, as the DoD was interested in additive manufacturing and how they could push these systems forward, say into the theater to do replacement parts, what are the potential health hazards, environmental risks, how to deal with waste and things like that in the environment. And so that's actually interesting. One of the larger programs that stood up a few years ago was focused on that. And then as we grew expertise in those programs, it kind of spun out to all of these other applications. And so looking at military engineering applications, rapid repair of infrastructure, the thing that has really grown, and I know we'll talk about a little bit more probably, is the whole computational side of it, computational design, computational manufacturing, mm-hmm. process optimization, and how sensors and digital twins are like connected in real time to manufacturing. That's a huge growth area. And then the other area is civil work. So while these military and more basic research investments are moving along, can we look at kind of mid-readiness level manufacturing technologies and start to apply them for infrastructure problems where, you know, really probably 5 years ago, there wasn't an appetite to do that. Mm-hmm. Now those technologies are really proven out.
Going back to that point on infrastructure, and there's this large amount of aging infrastructure. What is it about additive manufacturing that can really help fill that void and help us meet that need?
I think today, and I do want to ask Zach this too, because he's a lot more technically astute on this than me, but you know, at least today, I think there's like a confounding challenges between what's available in industry, and that's both just capacity, like how many forges there are, how many in our labor workforce even know how to do this kind of stuff mm-hmm. anymore. There's a capacity challenge. We're challenged with a backlog from COVID, right? And when we hear about that every day on the news, all the supply chain challenges and mm-hmm. there's geopolitical aspects of that too. And then also the fact that we're not building thousands of these things at the same time. We might only want to build one part, right? And so techniques like additive that are really good at unique one-off components are much more competitive in that environment than, say, a typical way we would produce something that would only be efficient if you were going to do it in the thousands, right?
Sure.
So those factors today, I think, make some of these new technologies especially competitive. And then Zach has pointed out, I think, a lot of the work where we can even improve materials and designs from where they were before, I guess.
Yeah, there's definitely a space there for what we call like topology optimization and kind of modernizing some of these infrastructure components, really dated structures that are using the same components as they were then. And so being able to go through and do a DFAM, right? So design for additive manufacturing and optimizing some of these parts really helps cut down on some of the costs associated with it. Because for additive, one of the things that's great is the cost is almost directly related to how heavy the part is, because it's most of that cost is in raw material, because you just have some kind of robotic platform or something like that that's going through and actually printing the part. There's not a lot of labor intensive components to it. So if you're able to kind of cut down on some of those weights, remove material, then you can really drive down the cost. And then kind of as Robert mentioned, these one-off components, if you go to one structure and I drive 2 miles down the road, the part, the sector gear, the whatever it is there is going to be different than the structure I just came from. Yeah. And so additive really started out as kind of almost a prototyping capability, right? So being able to take something, develop it rapidly, and then have a prototype to show to project sponsors. But that's almost what we're doing from the infrastructure space. Each one of those individualized components is almost like a prototype, because we only need like one or two of them. And so it really kind of helps additive shine in that particular category.
Sure. Zach, we talked a lot about additive manufacturing. Another, I guess, term that you all use a lot is advanced manufacturing. Tell us kind of what all that encompasses. I guess that even goes beyond additive manufacturing, and where is Erdc playing in that field?
Advanced manufacturing is kind of the term to kind of encompass it all, right? Modern technologies, if you will. Additive is one of those, but you also have subtractive processes, or what we call hybrid manufacturing, in there as well, where you're doing some kind of additive process and then going through and removing material to have your end result. So a lot of additive processes require some kind of post-machining or something associated with it that makes it more of a advanced manufacturing and not just what we talked earlier about 3D printing, right? It's not just a small part, I remove support material and move on. So there's a lot of other engineering and design that goes into understanding that. For Erdc, we kind of have, we'll say, five pillars, if you will, for advanced manufacturing. One of those is going to be additive construction. A lot of that work's being done in our construction engineering research lab, or CERL, and that's focused on a lot of concrete printing, like barracks systems for vertical construction. We also do a lot of what we call horizontal additive construction as well, for repair of, say, runways or road systems or bridging, things of that nature. But a lot of that work is centered around cementitious materials.
So that would be, just to drive the point home, I mean, I've heard printing a building or printing a bridge and so forth.
Exactly. So printing full-size structures or buildings out of traditional concrete materials. So there's a lot that goes into that, whether it's material side of the house and working with our concrete materials branch in GSL to be able to understand like rheological properties and be able to get the resulting strengths. But then you've still got to have a cementitious material that goes through your actual pump and hoses to be deposited. But then a lot of things that people don't understand about additive when you start getting to large scale, what we call large format, is the software and hardware side of things. So you think about like materials and how we're going to print these and different technologies, but you don't really think about the software of how you develop toolpath designing for all these different processes and things. So there's a lot of that work that's being done as well. Another area that we've gotten into, and Robert alluded to this a little earlier, is more on the environmental side of the house. And so that started off pretty early on with environmental health and safety aspects of additive manufacturing. So looking at these really fine metal powders for laser powder bed fusion and things like that. Over the years, it's kind of evolved into more traditional engineering with nature type applications. So trying to use dredge material to be of use. And so things like artificial habitats or wave breaks, things like that. And they've also had a good bit of success on using additive process to create porous structures for filtration. A lot of times people think of pores being a negative side effect of additive and poor print quality, but that actually can have some good properties as well.
Now on that point, another point I want to make sure we drive home to the audience, they are using dredge material as print stock to print these structures as well.
That's right. So not only taking a material that would typically be considered as waste, but then also printing it for applications that help the environment, artificial reefs and things like that, really kind of giving back to the environment with something that would typically be a waste product.
Yeah, sure.
Another area is more kind of what my traditional background is on the material side of the house. So a lot of people think of additive as these like complex geometries of like really complicated like aerospace components and things like that. But The other thing is you can use it as a technology enabler to develop new material systems. A lot of what we've done in the past few years is metal matrix composite, being able to take an additive process and using the actual process itself to, say, dope a base material with high hardness carbides or something like that to create layering schemes or functional gradations for a lot of different applications. Maybe on the military side, those are high hardness systems for impact, or maybe on the civil side, it's high wear performance. But there's a lot of additive processes that we can leverage to create these new materials,
sure,
as well as getting into what we had kind of mentioned earlier is topology optimization, right? So the traditional, really complex aerospace component. Another area is working with our information technology lab, ITL, on development of computational tools. And so that can be systems that are going through and looking at residual stresses of different processes to kind of predict what remaining service part life might be. Or it could even be developing tools for in situ process monitoring and trying to develop feedback loop control systems, right? So instead of having to go through this multi-day or multi-week print, getting to the end and saying, oh, we had a defect halfway through, we need to scrap thousands of dollars worth of work and start over. Mm-hmm. Being able to have that in-situ process monitor to tell you, okay, you've got a defect coming up or you just had a defect happen. Advanced manufacturing kind of goes in and does some hybrid machining to take care of that, and then you start the process back up. But being able to leverage, say, things like supercomputing capabilities and the computational tools that are being developed to address and identify those defects on the fly and then be able to go through and repair them. And then kind of the last area that I'll get into is kind of a combination of a lot of those things. So it's more the large format side, trying to scale up the technology as large as possible. Most of the things that ERDC works in from an application space are really large. As we're talking about a good bit today, civil works infrastructure components on the civil side. On the military side, you're talking bridging and rail, so infrastructure, right? And so by necessity, the technology that we use has to be large. So being able to scale up things like additive friction stir deposition and do mobilization, or really kind of pushing the envelope, like we'll talk about in a little bit, as far as what is possible for arc-directed energy deposition or wire arc additive manufacturing, and really kind of scaling up those technologies for big applications in the space.
Yeah.
How has 3D printing technology matured through the years, and how has that opened new opportunities for applications? I'm sure you can do so much more now than you could when this first started.
Most definitely. 3D printing, I guess a lot of people don't really understand, has been around since like the 80s, right? So it started off with stereolithography, so little resin prints and using UV curable resin systems to create complex geometries. And we've really, really advanced that over the years. I think Robert mentioned a little bit earlier, as far as the last couple of years, really what ERDC's been getting into. To kind of highlight some of those things, so University of Maine has Guinness World Record for largest polymer additive manufacturing systems. You're talking really large components, so like 20-foot boats and things like that that can be printed. In recent years, with those advancements, it's really kind of opened up what is possible using additive. In the past, I kind of mentioned that aerospace components, right? Most people thought of additive as being something that you need some kind of small part that fits in this like environmentally controlled chamber to be able to create some highly complex part. That's not really the case anymore. We're coming out with new technologies that don't require those environmental chambers, and that gives us the ability to go bigger. And not only lets us go big, but it also lets us do repairs. So we don't, whatever my part is that I'm trying to repair on doesn't necessarily have to fit in that system anymore. And so with the advent of things like additive friction stir deposition or ARC DED, which is essentially just welding, it's just being automated through a robotic system and then building on that, we're really able to go through and kind of push the envelope here recently of what's been considered possible in the past.
So now as you do that, and you mentioned earlier, larger infrastructure is getting a lot more into the Corps of Engineers mission on the military side, on the civil work side. A really cool project you all were just involved with, and we talked about it at the beginning of the show, was printing this 12-foot part for the ship arrestor system at the POLOC, which is one of the two locks at the SULOX facility up in Michigan. It was the largest 3D printed civil works infrastructure part in the U.S. history. Can you talk a little bit about that project and its significance?
It's a really interesting project, and it's come about, I think, a lot faster than I would have ever thought we would do this. So, you know, as Zach said, the things we were doing in the past, small, you know, unique parts, unique alloys, we're finally getting to the point when we put something into an infrastructure project, it needs to be like totally scalable. It generally needs to be pretty cost effective. And it generally needs to be something that's not going to be done by some, you know, maybe one-off university custom-made machine, right? It needs to be made in a factory in the Rust Belt or something to get out onto a project. And so we're finally getting to that level in wire arc additive manufacturing. And so starting a couple years ago, we initiated a new partnership with Eaton Corporation and a couple industry partners and some academic partners. It was all driven by our headquarters asset management office. And so they're governed with how do we optimally invest our resources and do operations and maintenance across all of our projects. We're always resource constrained. And so their office figures out where's the best bang for the buck to put resources. Mm-hmm. And so they had some great support for the technology. And we eventually got it to the point that we were printing large, you know, like meter scale parts with the goal of having to demonstrate it to the field. And the work you alluded to with the Sulox and really, really championed by the Detroit district, I have to give it to their team because, I mean, they took the risk and bought into trying to use this technology to support a mission requirement. And so that was at the Sulox, which is a series of lock projects on the Great Lakes. It's the most important navigation project we have in the Corps. I think 90-something percent of all the iron ore in the U.S. goes through those locks and really critical to commerce in the region. And it's unfortunately really timely because of the ship crash in Baltimore. It shows us how important things like a ship arrestor arm are to the functioning of our infrastructure.
Right. So for people who understand, I mean, what the ship arrestor is doing is it's preventing the miter gates on the lock from being hit by, you know, in an emergency situation by a wayward ship.
Yeah, it'll slow down, what is it, something on the order of 100,000-ton ship in less than 100 feet. And so trying to keep those kind of vessels from impacting our projects, because when those projects get impacted, you don't go buy the parts at Home Depot. Like, you're going to be down for, you know, years before you have an operational project again. So, you know, the Detroit district really leaned in on this technology and put it into practice.
And it started, Zach, maybe to segue, it started from a conference you gave, correct? And someone from the Detroit district heard you speak and that kind of started that collaboration?
Yep. Yeah. So we've definitely been doing work in this space for quite a few years now, as Robert mentioned, kind of starting back with some of the Eaton engagements that we've had over the past and really trying to understand material properties. More on the material side is kind of what my background was focused in. So going through some of these processes and being able to understand what their material performance might be like out the tail end after being able to produce something. That's kind of one of the big areas, right? It's quality assurance, quality control. So we were trying to go through and understand, all right, if we use these particular materials to replace, say, a cast steel or something like that, what would the resulting fatigue life look like? I had presented on some of that work at a lock maintenance workshop that we had. And then we've also done one of our structural technology symposiums here at ERDC. And through those engagements, we got somebody from Detroit District reached out. So it worked out really well. But yeah, there's been a lot of research in years past to try and get us to this point. So it wasn't like we all of a sudden decided, hey, let's 3D print this giant 12-foot, 6,000-pound part and let's go all in. There's been a lot of work by both ERDC and the community at large to understand how these materials are going to behave from the process. And then we have a lot, years and years of welding experience to lean on from the community and some of our partners.
And now that you've done it, I mean, again, we talked at the beginning of the show, going back, aging infrastructure, you know, the big problem and the constraints on trying to replace them. Now that it's almost to say a proof of concept that you've printed the part that has been installed there, I would assume opens up more opportunities.
Exactly. And that was I did a recent, we'll call it a tech talk. And that was one of the questions I posed. It's like, now that this is all done, would you do it again? And the answer was without a doubt, yes. And so that kind of shows us that moving forward, I always kind of explain it as not a MacGyver screwdriver. Maybe that's kind of dating us here, but it's not the one tool that's going to change or replace everything. But it does, I think, need to be slotted into the workflow of how you kind of down select what manufacturing processes you're going to use in the future. So maybe instead of just sending it out to casters to say, hey, I need this part made, you need to send it out to casters. You also need to send it out to additive manufacturers to see what makes the most sense economically and from a time standpoint.
And I think it's an important point maybe on that to talk about where ERDC's role would be in that sort of process. I mean, ERDC isn't going to 3D print all these parts, but you all would be heavily involved in coming up with designs and advising on which materials and what would work.
That's right. And yeah, so ideally, I would not be the middleman for life. I like to do research. That's what I went to school for. But what we do bring to the table is an understanding of the technologies and where it shines and where it's not good. And so each of these different processes all have their own slate of pros and cons, right? So like WAM, for instance, your feature size and resolution is going to be smaller than something like a laser DED. But then your material that you're going to be able to deposit is going to be faster for something like ArcDED or WAM. And so there's a lot of trade-offs there. And being able to navigate like who to reach out to, what parts are going to be great for additive and what parts just go through traditional manufacturing, or you could machine this significantly faster. Like we had a request to like, can I print on I-beam? Can you print an I-beam? Yes. Should you print an I-beam? No, because they're already ridiculously cost effective in the way that they're manufactured and they're readily available. But a lot of these parts that we're talking about, you may have an 18-month lead time associated with it. So maybe it makes sense to additively. So there's just a lot of pros and cons there that you have to weigh. And we can kind of help with the scales there. There was also a lot of industry engagement. So with these particular projects that they have a lot of very specified weld experience and things like that, that get brought to the table for a lot of these projects.
You could partner with them, in other words.
Exactly.
So circling back to large infrastructure, what are some of the challenges with printing these components and how have you been working to overcome those challenges?
Oh, a lot of challenges. All right. So one of the big challenges with 3D printing anything is residual stresses. And so especially when you start talking about 3D printing large things with metal, residual stresses become a big problem and you start getting issues with warping of your part. And so really having a good understanding of geometry, how residual stresses work and your thermal gradients in your part is kind of crucial. This is something that we saw in this part, and there's always lessons learned, right? So and the first one, we did have a little bit of an issue with residual stresses, but then we learned from that. And then the second part, we actually went through and put stiffeners in there in certain locations to hold everything straight before you can do your heat treatment and relieve a lot of those stresses that are in place. So there's a lot there that really has to be understood. And that's where a lot of work between ERDC and the industry partner went into place to kind of work some of those problems out. So the other big issue with 3D printing part is size. So we're still trying to push the envelope of what is possible here, right? With the ship arrestor lever arm, we are talking a 12-foot part that was 6,000 pounds, roughly. And so in order to execute on that, we're actually pushing the current capabilities of our industry partner. And so that was actually fabricated in two separate components and then traditionally welded together. And so it wasn't quite split evenly because there was a lot of work between ERDC, the industry partner, as well as the district to run like structural analysis to be able to understand, okay, well, we don't want to split it right here because it's going to be a high stress point. And so to be able to go through and use our current capabilities to fabricate the part, but also be able to not put that in a detrimental location, right? And so that was one of the other hurdles that we really kind of have to overcome is, yes, things are getting larger, but we still, like robotics arms are only but so large. And so really kind of working through some of that.
The industry partner for this particular project was Lincoln Electric, correct?
That's correct, Lincoln Electric.
And performance-wise, how do these 3D printed parts compare to traditional methods? Are they just as strong?
So that's actually one of the big pros for additive, or a lot of the materials we're using, is that we can get a lot more performance out of the materials that we're using from a weld or additive standpoint than we do the traditional cast alloys, at least for this particular component that we're going to talk about, I guess, more in detail. That may not necessarily be the case, but across the board, it's pretty common. And the reason for that is we're using more modernized materials that are designed specifically for these applications, whereas a lot of the parts that were in structure or fielded, like we said, 50, 60 years ago, they didn't have the material science knowledge that we have now. The other issue is that just from a material standpoint, there's material properties, but then also like defects within the part. So we'll pull parts off of a structure that failed after being in service for 40, 50 years, and it'll have these giant casting defects that are, say, like several inches in length in a part that lasted for 40, 50 years. And with additive, we have a lot more control over the process to alleviate a lot of those defects associated with it. So as you may have something on the order of inches in some of those cast components from 50 years ago, a lot of the porosity that we're seeing is more on the order of microns from a magnitude standpoint.
Okay, I love this question because I work in ITL. And in ITL, we are very proud of our high-performance computing capability. So how has ERDC's high-performance computing capability boosted this effort?
I think there's multiple aspects about how we're leveraging high-performance computing that are really, they're pretty interesting and they're only getting more interesting. So, you know, one, I think from a mission perspective is, you know, when you look at the other labs, they have fairly tangible missions kind of aligned with the Corps of Engineers. And I really see the work in high-performance computing and a lot of the work that ITL does is really an enabler for everything. And so It's been exciting to see that when we look at manufacturing technology, the computational side of it might be focused on aerospace parts or naval parts or vehicle parts and things that we may not dabble in within the other laboratories, but the ITL team is, because they're helping to enable a lot of those weapon systems and other kinds of capabilities. Mm-hmm. You know, before getting big into this Mantech space, I've always been real passionate about materials, and we've always had a huge modeling and simulation focus, leveraging high-performance computing. And I've seen that grow into the manufacturing space, but it's always been in pillars or stove. Pillars sometimes is a good word. I'll say stovepipes because it's negative. So we design materials, the materials people, the materials modelers do that. Then we might design structures or components, right? And there's structural people, designers that do that. There's this whole new space with things like advanced manufacturing that's more around modeling the manufacturing process itself. You know, how do we heat the material? How does the microstructure transform? How do you get residual stresses like Zach was talking about? Those things were generally like three separate stovepipes. And I think really only in the last, what do you think, Zach, maybe 3 to 5 years?
Yeah.
You started to see those all come together. And so I like to say that it's kind of the nexus of digital design, materials by design, and manufacturing process optimization. Or there's lots of ways people say mm-hmm. that. Because it's just all these new levers, right? You can do things with additive, making on-the-fly changes in the composition of the material. You can generate geometries you never could before. And then the whole time during that process, you can do real-time sensing tied to digital twins of the entire process to predict properties, to identify defects. And so all those things are coming together. But the thing all of those rely on is computing. They're all like really computationally intensive problems. And so we've seen a big ramp up, I think, in leveraging our high-performance computing capabilities to support that. A lot of it is focused on maybe not big machines that would sit back here at home, but edge computing systems that would like sit on the factory floor and be connected to one of these machines, mm-hmm. taking real-time data from sensors. It's making like real-time on-the-fly modifications to like laser power and dwell times and things like that to minimize defects. And so all that's just enabled by computing.
You all have talked about topology optimization earlier as part of this discussion. Can you talk more about kind of what that is and maybe how that, including knowledge of materials and design, and we talk about the computing and just how it's enabling us to make things that were never possible to be made before.
Topology optimization, I like Robert's knobs kind of analogy there. There's a lot of different knobs you can turn. And so historically, what we call topology optimization, or the ability to kind of optimize an existing part that you already have, as opposed to generative design, where you're using the computer to design a part that you don't have, you just have a set of boundary conditions. And then it's using some kind of code to tell you, okay, this is what your part should be. There's a lot of different things that can be done there. So what? Maybe you're trying to reduce weight. Maybe you're trying to increase, say, heat transfer. So there's a lot of work being done there. Maybe you want to do both. A lot mm-hmm. of work being done there to kind of develop computational tools, for one, and working with ITL to do a lot of that, as well as some of our industry partners. But then also you leverage those codes to develop new parts. And so we'll say like a connector arm for a sector gear, you know, take a lot of material out of that and reduce the weight for cost. But then we've also gone through and used those same optimization routines to try and increase the efficiency on like heat exchangers and such. And then a lot of the tools that we're developing has gone through and tried to do what we call like multimodal optimization. So historically, you could pick one of those things. I can do for weight or some kind of like strength property or heat, but I can't do for all of those things, or I can't have some kind of dynamic loading. And so a lot of the work that we've been doing in recent years is trying to come up with like a holistic approach or tool that can go through and optimize for all of those things. So now it's kind of goes back into what I called earlier, that DFAM, so that design for additive manufacturing. So it kind of becomes part of that process of not only am I being able to additively or design these parts for additive manufacturing, but then I can optimize them specifically for them and then fabricate them using an additive process that you couldn't make in traditional means. So like say these complex lattice structures or crazy overhangs and things mm-hmm. like that, that you wouldn't typically be associated with a traditionally manufactured machine part.
Can you be more precise also in where you're looking at? So if you're trying to optimize for heat or stress or whatnot, instead of the whole part having to have that property, you can place that optimization at a certain, you know, within a certain parameter? And is that kind of where you also get some cost and material savings?
Definitely. And you could do that two ways too, specifically with additive. Either I can optimize the part geometrically for that, or I can also do it from a material standpoint. So one of the areas that I have a lot of interest in is multi-material additive manufacturing. So whether we're going through and we're swapping out a material system, or I mentioned earlier, like layering schemes or functional gradations, right? And so with additive, for a lot of these processes, we can have hot swaps, or I can functionally grade a material system. So maybe I want like higher energy absorption or something like that, right? I can have a layering or a gradation of properties there to tailored specifically to whatever I'm looking for. Or for our heat exchanger analogy, maybe I'm changing like the density values, the porosity of that particular structure, or I'm changing the geometry of my heat fins and things mm-hmm. like that. It just really depends. But with additive, we have that flexibility and it's easy for me to change that on the fly and print, as opposed to like say a casting where every time I do that, I'm having to fabricate a new mold, which tooling is extremely expensive. Especially when we're talking about large components for that rapid iteration of the design process.
Sure.
How can this capability revolutionize USACE's asset management operations?
So I think, you know, a lot of the work that we're doing aligned with the Corps' asset management program, and they have a new strategy they just released and roadmap for their initiatives. And it's extremely multifaceted how we're going to do kind of systems engineering-based optimization of investments of maintenance resources. Maintenance, the other side of the coin of that is benefit. Like, where is the bang for the buck as far as mission impact? So they do a lot thinking about that. I think what we're trying to do here is to give a new series of tools in the toolbox that when they run into those long lead time parts on a critical project, or we do a dewatering for a maintenance cycle on one of our projects and we see something that's broken that we didn't even anticipate, or boy, it sure would be great if we could replace this part now versus have it break 2 years from now when it's not dewatered. And so we need more tools like that across the Corps to support those kind of maintenance activities. And that's what we've been trying to roll out with really different types of advanced manufacturing. So a lot of the examples we talked about are these big, unique parts, right? And I think that's going to be one line of effort that will probably be used across the Corps, is reaching back to industry, or eventually we may even have some of these capabilities in some of our maintenance fleets where we could do some of this as well. But I think moving forward, and this probably gets more into things we're already doing on the military side of our programs, is pushing those capabilities closer to the problem set. And so maybe rather than reaching back to a maintenance fleet, or you're awarding a contract to an industrial partner to support these parts, you know, maybe 10 years from now, the maintenance fleet itself that deploys to the project has some small, you know, additive manufacturing capability on board, like mm-hmm. on a floating plant. And so they could be producing some of these too. So I think the asset management program has this kind of hierarchical vision of how these capabilities could be deployed across the Corps. And so we're trying to work the low-hanging fruit that's out there today, but, you know, not lose sight for what the long-term challenges are too.
Another aspect of this maybe is, I guess for traditional manufacturing, when you're having to cast all these parts, you've got to have molds. And I believe you told me there's like warehouses filled with molds for when these parts, you know, may be needed. I think you said you all are also working on kind of digitizing some of that, that could eliminate the need for some of that physical storage.
You know, there's a whole change in workflow and like transforming and digitizing everything we do from, you know, paper drawings and wooden molds to everything being digitized in the future. And there's multiple efforts across ERDC, a lot of it being led out of ITL to do that. But I know, Zach, your team's been working directly with some of the maintenance units on some of that transformation.
That's right. So mainly looking at one of the biggest hurdles we get a lot of times when I'm asked, hey, can we make this through additive? Is the drawings that I'm handed, or I guess digitally handed. A lot of times these are like original, like scanned documents that pulled out of, it seems to me, like a dirty vault somewhere or whatever, right? Sometimes you can't read the numbers, or the angles are missing or something. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the lead time associated with getting some of these parts manufactured is because we have really dated drawings and they're relying on molds that are sitting in a warehouse somewhere, right? So going through and like digitizing a lot of these with 3D scanning technologies and such is something that we've been very interested in doing. And I think would help definitely cut down on some of the lead time associated with fabricating some of these components for sure. And that's one of the other beauties with additive, is it's beneficial from traditional manufacturing to have all these molds, so you don't necessarily have to make them, even though they're in a warehouse and they're probably broken. But from an additive standpoint, I don't need any of that. If I just have a CAD file that I can send to a vendor that we can do some tool pathing and slicing on, then we're good to go.
Yeah. We've talked about how additive manufacturing has a lot of military uses as well, and that you all have been heavily involved in that through the years. And one of the strengths of ERDC is kind of the ability to do both military and civil works research and kind of let each, you know, benefit the other. How have some of the lessons that you will have learned from military projects benefited some of this work into large format printing for, you know, large scale infrastructure?
That's one of the beauties of working in the material space. From material, it doesn't care what it's being used for. It has a set of properties, and what that application is doesn't really matter. And so we've had a lot of experience in the past years on the military engineering side, leveraging a lot of these high strength, low alloy steels and things like that for different applications that then we can kind of transition to the civil works infrastructure side. There's also been a lot of work in the coatings regime. So things that I mentioned, kind of like high hardness coating. So traditional steel will say 200 Vickers hardness. We're talking these metal matrix composites get up to like 2,500 Vickers hardness. So orders of magnitude higher than your traditional steel. That's great for like wear performance and things like that. So those are material systems that are originally developed for military engineering applications that now we can actually leverage for the civil works infrastructure side of the house. And then definitely, a lot of times it could go either way. It's sometimes easier to get things adopted on the military side because of the need that's associated there. And so scalability of technology and things like that happens a lot of times pretty quickly. I think we probably saw the opposite of that in this particular part because of the need associated with it. The technology was adopted a lot faster than I definitely would have thought possible. But there's a lot in that space too. So looking at things like mobile additive friction stir deposition that is being developed on the military engineering side that could potentially be leveraged for civil works infrastructure repair of existing structures and damage and things like that. Yeah, there's definitely a lot there.
Yeah, I think, the example you mentioned about coatings, that's kind of an interesting one. And it falls back to my boss used to say, like, a career, you don't climb a ladder in your career, you climb a jungle gym. And so I think a lot of these projects, these tech transfer activities are like that. In the case of that coating, that actually spun out of work in the mining industry.
Hmm.
And so they were trying to harden like teeth on bulldozers and things like that. And so we took that method, applied it for some military problems, scaled it up, and now it's being spun back towards a whole different set of civil problems that we never, I think, would have thought would be possible.
What are some other projects and capabilities that you want to highlight?
I'll highlight one. One area that I think is really growing, and we're going to see, I think ERDC having a big role, particularly in computing, is really around the quality assurance, quality control side of it. That's one of the biggest challenges, I think, in this whole community is we have an entire industry that's based off of conventional quality assurance. We make a whole bunch of parts, we take them back to the shop, we test them, we do some statistics on that, and if it looks good, you can use those. If you're making a small number of parts, you don't want to make 30 parts to validate one part, right?
Sure.
Nobody wants to do that. And so, computing combined with onboard sensing is just opening up this whole new, it's just like a revolution in manufacturing and the way that we would do quality assurance. Rather than conventional quality assurance where you do some experiments and make sure it meets some specification requirement. I mean, I think long range, and they've tagged this Born Certified. That should be a trademark, but Born Certified parts that you go through and you computationally design on the front end, you manufacture and you monitor in real time with onboard sensors to validate your model, and your model predicts defects and properties of those materials. Like, that's the future.
Yeah.
That's an area that I think we're really leading the way. It requires high performance computing to do today. I think a lot of advancements in AI, machine learning are going to help us do that in the future with reduced order modeling and edge computers. But it's a really exciting area. And there's a bunch of others. The engineering with nature base work on large scale additive, the work in additive construction. We just finished a additive construction standards workshop out at Fort Bliss. There's an interest in using that on military construction projects, and we need to figure out how to adapt our building codes and specifications to do it. So like all of these areas ERDC is working in, there's a lot of exciting developments, I think, over the next 5 years that are going to really shape the future.
Yeah. Robert, tell us about some of the partners y'all are working with.
I think across ERDC's programs, we all partner. I think there's very few, I don't even know of any ERDC programs that are probably don't have some type of a partner involved. But particularly in materials and manufacturing, we're heavily leveraging partnerships. We want to do some things in-house, understand the process, validate it. But like Zach said, we don't want to become a print shop forever. And there is just exceptional work in industry and academia, other government agencies. DOE has huge investments in this space and remarkable capabilities. So, partnering across government, industry, and academia, I think, is critical. And doing that in a way that's optimal from like a fiduciary responsibility, right, is what do we need to learn to take this technology into our mission? But these systems are expensive, right? So we want to prototype at a scale that makes sense for what we need to do. And when we need to scale it up, we're going to work with the right people in order to do that. And that ranges from, I would hazard, probably dozens and dozens of academic partners that all have their own unique set of expertise. Lots of industry partners, ranging from small businesses working on kind of new start, cutting edge technology. But a lot of that technology, the IP, gets bought up by bigger companies and they're kind of taking it to the next level. So we're really working across the board with a lot of different types of partners in these efforts.
And you mentioned unique expertise, and that's something that we have here at ERDC as well. So how is ERDC uniquely positioned to do this research, and how does this effort leverage historic expertise in our competencies?
I think our unique expertise in this space, and I find it time and time again, I think our domain awareness, like our understanding of the customer, because we're in the same command as a lot of the problems. Mm-hmm. And so connecting the academic community, connecting these capabilities in industry and aligning them towards customer-centric challenges, like how can we solve those type of problems? I mean, that's where I find us time and time again at, I think, is, you know, we may not be the ones developing crazy new fundamental metallurgy simulations to design new metals or whatnot. But we can take the output of those academic models and use it to design some new material that we're going to manufacture in a infrastructure part, right? Mm-hmm. Or for some force protection material. So I think there's areas that are heavily leveraged, but then there are areas that are unique. Like Zach mentioned, the work in environmental risk associated with advanced manufacturing, there are very few people in the entire world doing things like that. The work in using natural and nature-based features constructed using advanced manufacturing is a unique area. Additive construction. We were starting some of that probably 7 to 8 years ago when it was a totally new thing for expeditionary construction. And now that technology is like flourishing in industry. They're building homes and commercial structures and all kinds of things. So I think along the timeline of development, there are a lot of unique things that ERDC has developed along the way in the space. But then there's a lot of areas that we're leveraging work that other folks are doing within our mission set.
And this effort cuts across multiple ERDC laboratories too.
Yeah, pretty much every lab has a part of this. I would say heavily the geotechnical and structures lab, construction engineering research lab, environmental lab. If you go to Krell, I was just up at Krell and they actually hosted
the Cold Regions Lab.
Yeah, Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab. And they hosted, it was really cool, for the Office of Secretary of Defense Manufacturing Technology Program, they hosted a point of need manufacturing challenge. So that's what a lot of their interest is get into the theater. We're going to make everything from blood to helicopter parts, right? And how we're going to do that in an Arctic environment. So Krell hosted this group up there and it was really fascinating. But you go walk around the lab and they're 3D printing ice structures. So they're adding like cellulose, nanofiber reinforcement into water and then 3D printing it to make ice structures that are ice composites.
Yeah.
Really, really cool stuff.
Talk about your backgrounds. How did each of you get to be involved in this research?
Yeah, so my background's in, I'm a research mechanical engineer. So I've been with ERDC for about 9 years now, which sounds kind of crazy as I'm saying it, mainly in the materials space. So the additive or advanced manufacturing was kind of a logical leap there. A lot of my PhD research was focused around additive manufacturing technologies and how can we use them for increasing material properties and things like that. And so a lot of this work is kind of really centered around some of the things that I've done for years now and really kind of enjoy because of the flexibility that you have there from a material standpoint, and then kind of getting into the different application spaces from a civil and military side.
So my background in academic training is not necessarily in advanced manufacturing, right? I did work in construction materials and did work in metallurgy. Since joining here at ERDC, I've really moved out in the material space and really over the last 10 years or so, you know, really trying to learn and grow our efforts in advanced manufacturing because there was so much opportunity there, right? There's so much benefit to the mission that could be gained by that. And so, you know, really leading efforts in programs and strategic initiatives. You know, recruiting, we have to have people and partners to do all of this type of work, and then building up our capabilities is what, you know, I've been passionate about in getting this work across the finish line.
I guess to add on to how we came with this particular effort is, so as one of the leads for a lot of our advanced manufacturing efforts, I've been kind of spearheading a lot of this CivWorks infrastructure work along the way, and then Detroit District kind of approached. We had some ongoing materials research and stuff, and kind of became the ERDC being the center between both the traditional USACE district side of the house and then the industry partners to kind of help provide some of that expertise.
What's on the horizon for this research?
I think we're on the verge of like a new industrial revolution. I think things are really going to change over the next 10 to 20 years. Every one of these new manufacturing methods, whether it's polymers, composites, metals, it's starting to move into the construction industry. The construction industry is a lot more challenging than typical manufacturing, just based on culture and the way construction is done. But I think every industry is on the verge of being revolutionized by this combination of manufacturing technology, automation, computing. I think it's going to be crazy. And so there's all these concepts, Industry 4.0 and Factory of the Future. And I think things are just going to look a lot different than they did in the past. And it's going to be enabled by all of these different investments. I think the challenge is, and we see this already, is coordination of all those activities, right? Because there's so much happening and it's all happening in parallel at the same time. The strengths are really when those things are connected to each other. But it's going to happen.
One of my colleagues kind of talks about it like the microwave, right? So when it started out, there's just a few houses that had it. But then like now you can't look at a house that doesn't have a microwave in it. We talked about 3D printing early on, and I mean, my kids have them at school for projects and stuff like that, right? They're everywhere now. Just these, it's really economical to just go and buy a small little tabletop 3D printer. And so as kids start to grow and they're familiarized and they graduate with these technologies, it's going to be secondhand for them to turn to it from a larger scale standpoint to kind of solve some of these problems. And as AI and ML become more prevalent in a lot of the technologies that we do and be able to address that QAQC, quality assurance, quality control problem that we talked about earlier. It's like everything now, like every time I turn around, it's like AI is kind of like generating photos and stuff like that. I mean, if it's able to go through and look at my data that I've done for these additive processes and say, hey, this print's going to be good, then it takes a lot of the hesitancy out of the technology. And I think we're going to see a huge adoption, like Robert said, here in the foreseeable future for large manufacturing industry.
Yeah, so I mean, it's going to be fascinating, as you both said, to see this and what's next. And I appreciate the research that you guys are doing and where it's leading. Thank you guys for taking the time to join us and talk about it.
Yeah, thank you too.
No problem.
Erdc's advanced manufacturing research will accelerate tenfold the speed of replacing large-scale vintage metal infrastructure components while optimizing materials and designs to meet specific performance requirements. Ultimately, this will improve the reliability of critical flood risk management and navigation infrastructure to protect communities and preserve economic growth.
The Power of Erdc podcast is a production of the U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center. Follow Erdc on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter X for the latest information. You can listen to the Power of Erdc podcast in all major podcast players. Visit powerofertigpodcast.org for more resources. You can also contact us at powerofertigpodcast@usace.army.mil. That's all for today. We'll see you next time.